Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. People who were kids in the 1980s and 90s often have kids themselves now, and we, or they, find themselves talking about what might seem like ancient history. That once upon a time, the idea of a TV network aimed expressly at kids was a new concept. It started with Nickelodeon, which created a common bond between kids from around the country, ranging from shows like Double Dare to Clarissa Explains It All to All That. Kids who grew up then still reminisce about those nuggets of entertainment. Matthew Klickstein was one of those kids partial to Salute Your Shorts and You Can't Do That on Television. As a grown-up, he interviewed the people who created Nickelodeon and who starred in the shows he grew up with, and the result is the new book Slimed, An Oral History of Nickelodeon's Golden Age. Klickstein spoke with Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson about whether a book like this could even be possible 30 years from now.
Well, that depends on what you mean by possible in a book like this. You know, a lot of the people I talk to have been a party to the development of a lot of different cultural institutions. A lot of the people who helped to create Nickelodeon also helped to create MTV, for example, or other networks. We're really getting involved in the digital revolution that's been going on over the last few years. So many of them actually would tell me that what's funny about what you're doing right now, speaking to me, is, you know, you'll probably have the same. There'll be someone doing this about some of the big YouTube shows that are on right now, say, or the golden age of YouTube or the golden age of Hulu or Netflix, maybe. So I think that there will always be oral history. It's a tradition that goes back, you know, all the way to the beginning of man. I mean, the first stories ever told were oral, whether it was Homer or people we don't even know about. I actually, in preparing for the oral history aspect of this book, I actually read a book that was written, I believe, in the late 60s, if not 70s, called Edie, about Edie Sedgwick, that George Plimpton put together. So I think that there will always be oral histories. It's a genre I really enjoy. It makes it an easy read. You're really, I want to say hearing, but you're reading the story of whatever you're learning about from the people who actually made it. You don't have a biased opinion from the author. I really took myself out of this. And I'm a documentary filmmaker as well, which is why I don't really mind saying, yeah, I'm not necessarily the writer of this book as much as I am maybe an editor or curator, if you will. I feel very much like I edited together and produced a documentary in the making of this book. It just happens to be on paper rather than on the screen. So I think there will always be oral histories, for sure.
Is there a reason why you chose to do it in book format rather than a film documentary?
Actually, what's funny is it started off as a different kind of book originally. I am a huge fan of a creative nonfiction writer named Michael Azarad, who wrote a terrific Nirvana biography, and then another book that's one of my favorites of all time called Our Band Could Be Your Life, about the 80s music underground, about such bands as Sonic Youth and Minor Threat and whatnot. And I've read it multiple times, and it reads like Tom Wolfe, and I'm also a big fan of Tom Wolfe. And I just always thought that I would do something like Our Band Could Be Your Life, where every chapter is about a different band, but I would do that with something that I really was passionate about and that I really knew a lot about. And, you know, at one point I decided to do that with Nickelodeon. I happened to be reading a lot of Tom Wolfe at the time. So originally I was going to do it more of each chapter would be about different show, mm-hmm. and that I would actually write it, because I am a professional writer as well. I'm a journalist, and I've written a few other smaller books that were published by much smaller publishers. So I wanted originally to do it that way, but just with the trend of oral histories, the MTV oral history has just come out, and the accessibility of oral histories, that's kind of what it came down to. We actually, at one point, were in a bidding war with two different publishers, and the other one wanted it to be more of the Tom Wolfe version, but Penguin won out for multiple reasons. I'm glad that they did, and we decided to go with an oral history in that case, which was a very challenging but interesting process in itself.
Mm-hmm. And I like that because you got to hear directly from the people who were on the shows, and when I was reading it, one of the things that was a big thing to talk about in one of the chapters was the slime. And I didn't realize that you got paid more if you were slimed, and all the different backstories behind the slime about what it was made out of, how it was created. So what did the slime symbolize?
The slime was a really great semiotic for Nickelodeon itself, I feel. This symbol represented Nick starting in these humble beginnings with actual grime and grit. The actual slime, for anyone who doesn't know, and they probably don't until they read this book, was the very first time someone was slimed on You Can't Do That on Television, which is where it came from, was an actor named Tim Douglas. And they dumped leftover foodstuffs that had been sitting in a bucket for a week on him. So it was actual slime. And that kind of represented Nickelodeon at the time. It was kind of DIY, get what you can get together, do what you can, make it work, be innovative, push it, risk it, and go for it. And, you know, let's just all in this together, and you're going to get real slime poured on you. And then over the years, you know, they kind of bottled it up, if you will, and changed the recipe a few times. Obviously, they couldn't keep dumping, you know, rotten food on kids. You know, times changed. The network changed. And before you knew it, it's what it is today, which is it's quite literally vanilla pudding with some water and green dye. And now it's poured on the likes of Tom Cruise and Katy Perry and what have you. So I think that that is a really great metaphor for the way Nickelodeon changed over the years. And in fact, I believe it was Alan Goodman, who was one of the people who helped to rebrand Nickelodeon during its golden age and also worked a lot on MTV. He's the one who said, you know, what changed over the years is the slime got prettier, the slime got cleaner. You know, the adults got in charge of the slime. It wasn't this actual goopy, disgusting stuff that it was back in the day.
And with the branding, one of the things that was said in the book was that there really wasn't any branding. And for me, as a kid from back then, oh, I see the orange with the white lettering, and that's always Nickelodeon. And it took different shapes and everything like that. And I'm kind of wondering, why did they go that route?
Alan Goodman and his partner Fred Seibert were the geniuses behind that, and they worked with a man named Scott Webb and a few others, Tom Pompicello, Tom Clack. But it was mainly Fred and Alan who devised this idea of making Nickelodeon a destination point. And they were also the ones who came up with the iconic logo for MTV, the original animation and riffs. That was Fred and Alan. So they really knew what they were doing. And they decided, rather than just bringing everyone in to watch these different shows, let's bring everyone in to watch Nickelodeon. And this was something that had been done in radio and magazines before. You're not reading a magazine necessarily for a specific author, a specific story, but because you understand that this magazine has a certain credence about it, you understand it's about a certain subject that you're interested in, and you're going to read it. And whatever stories are in there, you're going to hopefully enjoy. And so too with radio. This hadn't been done in television really before Fred and Alan got involved, and they decided to bring that mentality to television and make Nickelodeon something that you would watch whatever's on it because it's Nickelodeon, not necessarily just because of the specific shows on there. So the kind of branding that they brought on was, again, more of a destination point. It was something that you could come to. And what's really interesting about it, if you think about it, is a lot of the children's shows around that time were doing the same sort of thing where, you know, there were places. It was Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. It was Sesame Street. It was Pee-wee's Playhouse. Suddenly you had these places that you were going, these destination points. And that was something that Fred and Alan both helped to pioneer and were really tapping into, so that Nickelodeon was kind of a club. It was a clubhouse, if you will, to go to after school where you were understood, where you could just kind of rest and have fun. You weren't necessarily learning anything, which was kind of intentional. They didn't really want it to be educational. It was just for fun. And that's really what the early Nickelodeon during this time was all about.
Definitely. And I think it was interesting about how it's taking more of an MTV route rather than a Disney. Why didn't they want to go Disney?
For two reasons. One is they needed to delineate themselves from what Disney was already doing. It's important to note Disney Channel came out after Nickelodeon was launched. Nickelodeon was actually launched in 1979, but they didn't really get out there in the way that we know of them today until around 1983, 1984, which is around when Disney Channel came out. So the Nickelodeon came first. They were still competing very much directly with the Disney Channel for kind of the children's entertainment market. And what Nickelodeon decided to do, which was very smart, is rather than being a family network the way that Disney was, they decided to be a just straight-up kids network. They were narrow casting as opposed to broadcasting. It's just for kids. So doing, they made it much more scatological. They made the kids had a certain aesthetic about them that was much more, hard and realistic as far as, you know, they were fat, they had pimples, they had greasy hair. They were not the blonde-haired, blue-eyed cherubs that we saw on the Disney Channel. So it was really a way to distinguish themselves. And also the people running Nickelodeon at the time were kind of like those people. Fred and Alan, you know, are goofballs, and they like throwing things at each other. And Jerry Laybourne, who was running the network at the time, you know, she'd smash your face into a pie. And, you know, they really were like that. So that was kind of more their sensibility anyway than the kind of squeaky, clean, antiseptic Disney Channel folks that was going on at that time.
So let's talk about some of those shows. Like Clarissa Explains It All. One thing I didn't realize, except I grew up in the Midwest, is that the Clarissa was supposed to be set in the Midwest, but I didn't understand how What made it Midwestern?
I think just the average tone of it. You know, it was pretty clear that she was probably not in a big city. She spent a lot of time with her family. She spent a lot of time in her house, which also seemed rather Midwestern. It wasn't too big. It wasn't too small. You know, it wasn't an apartment in New York. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, this, you know, big lavish house in the Hollywood Hills. It was just a typical, you know, little kind of duplex, if you will. And, you know, it was relatively modestly furnished. Melissa, or Clarissa, if you will, and Ferguson, her brother on the show, you know, dressed in a way that was rather average, even though Ferguson, you know, tried to be the conservative William Buckley type. But neither of them kind of spoke like streetwise kids. Again, not a really big city. And they just seem like wholesome, regular folks. So I think that that reads as Midwestern in itself.
And it's okay for them to have Sam climbing up the ladder into Clarissa's bedroom every once in a while, too.
Yeah, because you know what? They're not in some kind of crazy big city where, you know, some kind of, you know, child molester or whatever is going to come through. Leave your doors unlocked. Leave your windows open. That was sort of the mentality of that show. And so I think that that definitely read as Midwestern.
Another show that you focused on was Rugrats, and it was kind of more of a diverse show than compared to some of the other Nickelodeon shows because it featured single parents to married parents and African-American families and mixed race families. And then there were different religions. And one of the stories that was focused on in here was that one character that caused some tension was Grandpa Boris, who was the Jewish father of Dee Dee and the grandfather of Tommy Pickles. And what was it about Grandpa Boris that caused such tension?
Well, it was both Grandpa Boris and Grandma Minka because they were from the old country, you know, straight out of Fiddler on the Roof. And they had, you know, the heavy Russian accent. And they looked like as Michael Bell, who was the voice of Grandpa, along with some of the other characters on the show, said they looked like, you know, potatoes. But what the irony is that though the Anti-Defamation League came in and said, hey, these look like caricatures that would be done by people like Hitler, you know, making fun of Jews and making them look like potatoes, I guess, if you will. The irony is most of the people on Rugrats were Jewish, from the writers to the producers to one of the creators, Paul Germain, I believe, was Jewish. And, you know, certainly Melanie Chardoff, who was the voice of Grandma Minka, as well as Mom Dee Dee on the show, and Michael Bell, pretty sure, was Jewish as well. In fact, I know that he was because he talked about his grandpa looked like an old potato. You know, basically, Michael and Melanie were doing their grandparents, or doing their parents. And they did it so well that there were groups that thought that they were being racist against Jews. However, as it says in the book, the real victory came out in that when they showed the episode at various synagogues and whatnot, I believe on Passover, people were cheering, people were excited, people were glad to see this. And, you know, I think that that's really important.
Matthew Klickstein, thank you so much for being on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Eleanor.
Lake Effect's Eleanor Peterson spoke with author Matthew Klickstein on his book, Slimed, An Oral History of Nickelodeon's Golden Age. The book was just released late last month. That's Monday's edition of Lake Effect. Tomorrow on the show, a writer returns to UWM to learn why so many African-American students struggle and often fail to graduate, and will deconstruct the mystique surrounding one tricky section of the ACT. I'm Mitch Teich. Fantastic to have you along for the ride today, and I sure hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. It's 11 o'clock. Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.